From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Ed Morin, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, May 31st, 2018. And on this day, in the wake of two child abuse deaths, the governor joined children's advocates today in calling for changes to Maine's child protection system. We hear about an unaccompanied minor who travels to New England to find her mother. That's ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by Norway Savings, supporting the colorful vision of Maine's business owners. Live your life in color. NorwaySavings.bank.
Maine Governor Paula Page joined children's advocates today in calling for stronger state laws and policies to protect children in cases of abuse and neglect. The recommendations were made at a public hearing in Augusta, 1 week after a report was released about the state's handling of two recent child abuse deaths. Patty White reports.
The first speaker at the hearing before the Government Oversight Committee, Governor LePage, said current child protection laws set the wrong priority: reunification of an abused or neglected child with their family whenever possible.
Reunification should be a tool in helping get what is best for a child. But reunification should not be the priority, and that's what we have right now.
LePage made the recommendation as he presented the findings of Maine's Department of Health and Human Services internal review. It was prompted by the deaths last winter of 10-year-old Marissa Kennedy and 4-year-old Kendall Chick. Because of confidentiality laws and a pending criminal investigation, the details of how the state handled the two cases are unclear. But both deaths were preventable, LePage said. He also highlighted the importance of upgrading the state's outdated computer system that tracks reports of suspected abuse and neglect.
If we'd had an up-to-date, state-of-the-art system, red flags would have been flying very high.
The governor also said that mandatory reporting, the requirement that certain people like teachers, physicians, and police report suspected abuse or neglect, is an issue. He wants a new state law that would make failure to report abuse or neglect a criminal offense. That proposal got a lukewarm response from many who testified.
I have to say I am on the fence about criminalization.
Child abuse pediatrician Dr. Lawrence Ritchie says he is certain, however, that mandated reporters need better training.
It is critical and not happening.
Better training was also identified by the governor and many others as a need for child protection caseworkers. Dr. Emily Douglas, a Massachusetts-based expert on child maltreatment deaths, told lawmakers her national research has found many caseworkers fear a child in their caseload will die, but they often don't know the correct risk factors to watch for.
Can you imagine working in such a high-stakes profession and not having the best knowledge and research tools to adequately do your job? Child welfare workers can. You can just ask them what it's like.
Maine's child welfare ombudsman, Christine Alberi, has also identified instances in which caseworkers fail to recognize risk factors for children in her recent annual reports to the state. Part of the solution, Alberi says, is not only more training, but reduced workloads, especially for those who train and guide caseworkers.
I think that supervisor caseloads and supervisor staffing are almost more important, if not as important, as caseworker caseloads.
Former state caseworker Mark Moran told lawmakers that there also needs to be better information sharing between those who interact with the child protection system.
In day-to-day practice, access to information is often determined by the quality of interpersonal relationships among service providers and local communities. The result, therefore, is inconsistent sharing of information, which creates gaps through which at-risk children fall.
Moran lamented to lawmakers that he tried to get input for the hearing from those who are well-positioned to identify systemic flaws, current caseworkers from the Office of Child and Family Services, but was unsuccessful.
I received a polite but clear response that OCFS staff had been directed to not speak about the OPEGA report or the ongoing review process.
The next step in that process is a work session for lawmakers on the Government Oversight Committee at the end of June. A special legislative session could follow to address issues. When the committee asked Governor LePage if he'd be willing to call a special session, he said yes. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Addiction treatment agencies with State Department of Health and Human Services contracts are weighing the implications of a new payment policy. Some say could result in serving fewer clients in the midst of Maine's opioid crisis. Bangor's Wellspring Agency operates a 10-bed detox center in Hamden. And Executive Director Suzanne Farley says she's not sure whether her organization can continue operating under the state's new fee-for-services policy that becomes effective July 1st.
It doesn't look very promising right now, and my board's aware of that. My staff are aware of that. I'm optimistic, though, that the state will try and help me figure out a way to sustain this operation. It seems like in good conscience they would want to. We still have people dying from opioid overdoses.
Sheldon Wheeler, director of the Office of Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services for DHHS, says all of the treatment centers should be familiar with the fee-for-services system and that there's been no decrease in the agency allocations for those contract holders. Wheeler says the new system will provide consumers with greater access to addiction treatment services. The legislature's Appropriations Committee last night reported out a mini-budget bill. It keeps current pay levels for direct aid workers and provides some money for county jails. Mal Leary reports agreement came after testy negotiations.
The tone of the negotiations between the leaders of the Appropriations Committee was tense, and at times tempers flared, and it looked like nothing would be accomplished. But after several back-and-forth negotiating sessions, the leaders settled on a very limited bill, addressing only three measures out of over 100 left in limbo when the legislature adjourned. Other issues will be considered when the panel meets again, which could be next week. When there will be a special session to act on this agreement and other bills, including bond proposals, won't be decided until further agreements are hammered out. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Concerned that the U.S. government has lost track of some children who recently immigrated to this country on their own has brought the experience of unaccompanied youthful immigrants into public view. These children are placed with sponsors, usually parents or other relatives already living here. As part of the New England News Collaborative, reporter Shannon Dooling has the story of one unaccompanied minor's journey to Everett, Massachusetts to find her mother.
Lily is now 18 years old, but her story begins a few years ago in Honduras when Lily was just 16, traveling north with her 12-month-old son.
There is a couple of reasons that I came here, but the main reason is because there is a lot of violence in Honduras.
We agreed to refer to Lily by her middle name because she fears for her family's safety and because she's a survivor of rape. Her son, she says, is a product of that sexual assault. When Lily and her son left the country in 2016, Honduras had one of the highest rates in the world of violent deaths among women.
I left in the morning one day, took my kid and a couple of money, and took a bus to the Guatemala border.
From there, Lily made her way up to Mexico, where she worked for a few weeks and then found a smuggler to help her cross the border into the U.S. She says she walked through the desert for hours, carrying her baby and sharing a bottle of water among six people. Eventually, she was picked up by immigration officials.
They asked me if I had a family or whatever. I told them, yeah, that my mom was here in Massachusetts, and they called her. She finally answered the phone. One of the officers told her that they had her daughter in the detention center.
Lily spent a few days in that detention center before she was transferred to a shelter in California, where she received trauma counseling. In the meantime, her mom, in Everett, was receiving home visits from a caseworker. The visits were designed to make sure that Lily was going home to a safe place. She hadn't seen her mom in 11 years. Nearly 2,000 unaccompanied minors were released to sponsors throughout New England from October 2016 to September of 2017. Jeffrey Thielman heads up the Boston-based International Institute of New England, which contracts with the federal government to help facilitate the placement of unaccompanied youth with sponsors.
Our program is designed to help the children who come to the border, who are unaccompanied, who are then put in a detention center for a period of time, paroled, and often have family in this region of the country.
But Thielman says the agency's work is becoming more difficult for a few reasons. One is the Trump administration's decision to end a program that allowed young people in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala to apply for refugee status while still living in their home country. It was designed to stem the flood of unaccompanied minors at the U.S.-Mexico border in 2014. The end of the program means young people looking to reunite with family may instead make the dangerous trek alone. Another obstacle, Thielman says, is finding the sponsors, the family already here in the U.S.
I think a lot of sponsors don't want to come forward because they may be undocumented themselves, and they may fear talking to government authorities because they could be subject to deportation.
Recent reports that the federal government lost track of nearly 1,500 unaccompanied youth who'd been placed with sponsors has sparked anger and inspired the social media hashtag Missing Children. Health and Human Services Deputy Secretary Eric Hargan said in a statement that these 1,500 or so children are not lost. Instead, he says, their sponsors simply did not or could not respond to follow-up calls made by his agency. Lily has applied for asylum here in the U.S. for herself and her son. She's in school and is studying Italian. She and her son are still living with her mom, who is in the country without authorization. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Shannon Dooling.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And for Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine, Thursday, May 31st, 2018. Thanks to Susan Sharon, AJ Higgins, and our digital team, I'm Ed Morin.